All right, right. So let's recap a little bit. Last week we talked about Joseph, right? And so Joseph was in Egypt, and the Pharaoh gave him all this power, and then from there he asked his father and his brothers to all come and move to Egypt. And they all moved to Egypt, and they were given actually a lot of silver and wealth, and they were allowed to settle there. And they started to grow, and they started to multiply there. And it was pretty amazing that God kind of opened this door for the nation to sort of develop in Egypt. They were actually in safety, relative security, and they were allowed to have this chance to kind of grow. But as we come to Exodus chapter 1, right, it starts to say that things sort of changed. And picking up from verse 8, it says, "Eventually a new king came to power in Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph or what he had done. He said to his people, 'Look, the people of Israel now outnumber us and are stronger than we are. We must make a plan to keep them from growing even more. If we don't, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies and fight against us. Then they will escape from the country.'" So if you understand like kind of Egyptian history, there's like this change, or Pharaoh regime will kind of change. And what happens is this guy comes along, and now he doesn't know about Joseph, or doesn't know why all these foreigners are in this land. And so he starts saying, well, you know what? We should have a policy change. Instead of these people living in the land and being part of our people, because even then they were separate, right? There is the Egyptians who would do their Egyptian things, and these people would come just live in their land. He said, well, let's change that. Because one day these people might have join our enemies and come and attack us or overthrow us. So looking on, right, then in verse 11 it says, "So the Egyptians made the Israelites their slaves. They appointed brutal slave drivers over them, hoping to wear them down with crushing labor. They forced them to build the cities of Pithom and Ramses as supply centers for the king. But the more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more the Israelites multiplied and spread, and the more alarmed the Egyptians became. So the Egyptians worked the people of Israel without mercy. They made their lives bitter, forcing them to mix mortar and make bricks and do all the work in the fields. They were ruthless in all their demands." Now, you have to kind of understand and imagine what's happening here. I know in the UK there's a lot of talk about World War II and Hitler, and how within this country, right, there becomes a change where they suddenly start to turn against the Jews, where they start to believe that Jews were subhuman or people that weren't the same level as the Germans. And this has not only happened during the time of the Germans. Actually, every sort of genocide sort of reflects that thing where you have a people who suddenly reject another people. And that's what's happening here. I think we understand, like, what's happening is they've turned these people into slaves. Now, it doesn't mean they're just the labor force or, like, servants, but you actually sense that there's a deep animosity towards these people. There's a shift in perspective of what these people are like or what they're good for. What you have here is the Egyptians begin to look at the Hebrew, growing Hebrew nation as subhuman, not worthy to be on that land, and should just be oppressed and pushed down. It's a real shift in terms of power struggle. And I think sometimes we forget or we don't think about, well, actually, they had become slaves, where there are no rights given to them, there is no land, and not just that, people were angry at them. You know, there's racial abuse going on. There's being cut off from where they are allowed to go. They're forced into certain areas. For a lot of us, we don't appreciate or understand that so much, because in the UK, we've been blessed, actually, because we're not necessarily segregated like that. But this is the same sort of stuff that was happening in Hitler's time with Rwanda. And as you look back, you understand, okay, this is something that we see over and over again, this sort of injustice. But what's happening at the same time is as the Egyptians are oppressing these people, they keep multiplying and they keep growing. For some reason, God seems to keep blessing these people, so they keep developing and becoming a larger and larger nation. And the Egyptians are getting more and more afraid. They're like, this is not cool. So naturally, come up with a new plan. Verse 15 says, "Then Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, gave this order to the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. When you help the Hebrew women as they give birth, watch as they deliver. If the baby is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live. But because the midwives feared God, they refused to obey the king's order. They allowed the boys to live too. What's happening here is they're saying, well, now just kill the children, kill the infants. Now, back in these kind of cultures, actually child sacrifice was acceptable or understandable. This was not just child sacrifice, though, trying to offer up to a god. This was just saying, well, let's just kill them. Maybe on the lines of not even beyond abortion, it's just pure infanticide. And it's pretty brutal for us to think about. It's actually like, so the midwife helps deliver a baby, and then they're supposed to just take the baby boy, if it's a boy, and kill it and leave it there. Now, every mother who has had the chance to give birth to someone, or a baby, normally their own baby, it's not just someone that pops out. When they give birth to a child, there's this immediate bond. There's this desire to hold the child, to be with it. And what they're saying here is actually, no, that just gets killed. You just throw it away. The value of the life of one of these kids is nothing, is meaningless. And the reason they want to kill all the boys is because the boys then can't have an uprising, and then also you can't reproduce. You're not going to have lots of other kids because you've killed the man. So he's trying to, essentially, it's worse than the one-child policy in China. This is pure, actually Chinese people would only want to keep the boy. It's like the opposite of that, where they only want to keep the girl. But there's an amazing thing that sort of happens, right? These midwives don't do it. They don't kill this baby. Now, why don't they do it? And it says, right, because the midwives feared God. They feared God more than they feared anything else. Or they believed in God more than they believed in anything else. And this is such an important distinction for us to begin to think about. If we think about the Egyptians, what happened here? They used to live side by side, these two nations. And then suddenly, popular opinion began to change. The Pharaoh's rules changed. The Pharaoh's laws changed. And what was previously okay, that these Hebrews were human and acceptable, suddenly became, these Hebrews are subhuman. They're not important. And then it became a little bit further. Then it's like, now it's okay to kill these children. In other words, you see a moral scale that is based not on anything but either the Pharaoh's whims or on popular opinion. And that's a very, very dangerous place to be. When your morality is based on the society that you live in. Right? You see, that's exactly the kind of place that we are today, where our morality is subjective. If a law gets passed in this country because everyone has voted on it, then that becomes the new morality. That becomes the new acceptable norm. But your morality cannot be based on popular opinion, because then it just gets blown left and right by anything. And that's what's happening here. A morality that is decided by the government or by popular decision or opinion. But for the midwives, they're not living like this. Their morality is not based on what society is happening. They're not saying, you know what? You're right. Actually, the Hebrew people, they're dirty, filthy people. And they should be killed. Instead, what they're saying is, no, actually, we're Hebrew too, and we understand actually God is the founder and the creator and the one who establishes our morality. He's the one who has written into our hearts from the beginning what is right and what is wrong. And I fear God, or I trust God, and I depend on God more than I trust and depend on the Pharaoh. You actually look on, right? So in the next verse 20, right, because then the Pharaoh says, okay, this is obviously not working because there still seem to be a lot of Israelites. So now what I want you to do is every time there's a baby, chuck them into the river. Okay, all the baby boys have to be thrown into the river. It's funny because actually the midwives continue to ignore them. So God was good to the midwives, and the Israelites continued to multiply, growing more and more powerful. And because the midwives fear God, he gave them families of their own. It's funny, because now the midwives are getting families too, because they fear and trust God. They look to him first and foremost. Like, this is the key thing. The importance of our lives are being fixed by God, not God's laws being fixed by us. In other words, we cannot say we decide what God's law should be. Rather, we say God's laws are fixed and we follow those. We learn to trust him and look to him. The problem with that is that's hard. It's because we don't want to sometimes think about God's laws. We don't want to wrestle with those. I'll tell you what we do like to think about. We like to think about God's love. And that is a very true and wonderful thing. Do you know why? Because God is love. Without God, we don't understand love. We don't have love. Because of God, we have this amazing expression of love in our lives. We have community. We have relationship. We have the chance to know one another and discover a small piece of love, only to have that quadrupled when we understand the love of God. But at the same time, God says, look, there is love, and then there's a greater way to love. A greater kind of love that says what is right, as opposed to loving just to say everything is acceptable. Sometimes in modern society, we confuse acceptance for love. If you love me, you will accept me for who I am. If you love me, you will love me for all my flaws. Now, actually, now that I'm a parent, I realize that's not really love. If I love my child for all the flaws that they have, and when I talk about flaws, it's like they have a bad attitude and they're rude, that's not really loving them. If I really love them, I teach them. And I want them to grow, to become a better person, to be a greater force for good in this world. I don't just say, well, you just do whatever you want to do. That's not love. I remember when I was growing up, I'm such a bad son. My mom, we had a discussion in our family, and they were talking about growing up. And I turned to my mom and dad and said, you know what? If I were you and I was raising me, I would have been more strict. I think you guys were just too lenient with me, and I just don't think you did a good job. And now I'm so lazy. It's almost like I turn around and then just spat in their faces as parents. You've done a crap job, and I was ashamed. You know, I would do a way better job. And it's sad because in hindsight, you're trying to think, yeah, actually, I wish I was push hard. But my mom was like, yeah, you think it's easy to even convince you to do anything? It's not like we didn't try. So I was like, oh, okay, fine. Well, I'm sure I'll be a better parent. Nowadays, it's like, oh my gosh, mom, how did you do it? 3 kids. Oh, and you happen to make money. How did you make that happen? It's this thing where suddenly you realize actually your parents desire you not to just be the same kind of falling apart person that you always were, but a parent desires and yearns for their children to grow, to be better. And that's what love is, isn't it? Love is where you yearn and you desire so much for someone else to achieve that kind of potential for who they are or who God has made them to be. But somehow society has taken that idea of love away and they've replaced it with this fake kind of small piece of love, which is like, oh, as long as you're happy and I'm happy, then everything's okay and we're in love with each other. And then the marriages break down and they start to fall apart. It's because they're like, well, it just wasn't working. What does that mean, it just wasn't working? Well, they're not really, I don't know, I just don't feel that love for them anymore. But when we talk about working love, it is this desire to continue investing in someone, even if the change is slow, or it sometimes feels like things aren't moving, but that desire to have them grow is still deep in our hearts. The crazy thing is, the older I get, the more I realize the power I have to transform someone is so small. But the power that God has to transform someone's heart is unbelievably powerful. It's why there's more time spent on prayer than there is in just trying to argue with someone and convince them. Well, let's look on, because actually what happens then is this is supposed to be the story about Moses, right? So we come to Exodus and we understand now the Hebrew people are slaves. They are rejected by society. They are cut off. And for the most of us, we don't understand slavery. We're not from that kind of background. We don't understand that kind of thing. But this is what's happening with them. Forced into hard labor, rights denied, and actually the labor gets worse and worse. And we know through the story of Exodus that it just gets more and more unbearable. And that's why they start crying out for freedom, to be set free from their oppression. And Moses is born, and Moses, his mom, looks at him and says, oh, this kid is special. And when I read that, I think to myself, I'm pretty sure all parents think that about their children when it's born. Oh, this is so wonderful. He's such a special child. But she comes up with this plan to try to save her son. And it's funny because the command by Pharaoh is to say, you have to throw all the babies into the Nile. She does that. Except she puts them in a basket, right, and sends it down the river. And I think there's a little bit more to this. I think she understands that actually they're not too far from the Pharaoh's daughter's house. They also know that the Pharaoh's daughter must be getting, she's not that young anymore, and she doesn't have kids. For some reason or another, this Pharaoh's daughter is barren as well. And it's funny, we're starting to see all these repetitive things happen in the Bible. Barrenness happens a lot. That struggle for identity, for the ability to have children. The other thing that we see happen a lot is injustice or oppression of people. It's things that aren't right. And what's happening here is so this woman can't have babies, and then this baby comes floating down the river, and she opens up, oh, it's like Ka-El, right? It's like baby Superman. Just kidding, not really. Because he's not weakened by kryptonite. So she takes him out, and this is such a trap, right? So she goes, oh, a baby. And I never understand this because I'm not really keen on holding babies, but seeing many, many women, single or married, whenever there's a new baby, it's like, oh, can I hold it? I just touch it. And you're like, oh, I'm very much a man. What happens is then the sister comes out and says, oh, you've got a baby here. Do you want me to find a Hebrew woman to nurse this child for you? Like, oh, what a coincidence. Yes, actually, could you? And it's funny because they have to take the baby home, and she actually just lives at home. Moses just lives at home with his mom for a few years, right? It's pretty awesome. And then eventually moves into the palace. And we have this idea like, wow, God's providence is kind of all over this case. But I just want to point out one of the things is Moses' name means to lift out. And the Pharaoh, she names it that. In Hebrew, it sounds like to lift out. And she's like, oh, it's because I lifted it out of the water. But what's kind of interesting is that Moses then eventually becomes the guy who's involved of lifting the people out of Egypt, actually. And later on, actually, he becomes sort of this intercessor, one who lifts the people's requests to God or lifts out the issues of the people and brings it to God. So it's pretty interesting. But we come along, so we come into Exodus 2 now. We're picking up from verse 11. And we begin to understand a little bit about Moses' character, what he's like. Verse 11 says, many years later, when Moses had grown up, he went out to visit his own people, the Hebrews, and he saw how they were forced to work. So he knows. He knows he's not Egyptian. He knows that he is a Hebrew person. I guess living with his mom for all those years makes it pretty clear. And he goes out to see the people. And during his visit, he saw an Egyptian beating one of his fellow Hebrews. After looking in all directions to make sure no one was watching, Moses killed the Egyptian and hid the body in the sand. Now, reading this, you have to understand one of the things. This seems like this is one of Moses' few times of seeing what's like for his people. In other words, he's been living in sort of palace or royalty, cut off from this sort of slave labor or these poor parts. Well, essentially the ghettos, right? You have to understand what you're seeing is not just a wealth stratification, but a social stratification that's so separated him from his people. And when he arrives there and he gets to that point and he sees like what's happening, his heart is welled up with his injustice.
Like, what is going on? How is this even acceptable? And he sees this Egyptian beating on this guy. And he gets so riled up, and he looks to the left and right, and no one's here, and he kills the Egyptian. Now, the amazing thing is you see, actually, Moses has strong convictions. He has strong convictions so much so that he will act them out, even in the consequences where it's not right, where the sort of murder doesn't seem right. But at the same time, you see, but the injustice is still there. We see over, actually, if you look at political history, that these are sort of the events that sometimes can spark a revolution, right? You have one unjust situation, then a murder, and then before you know it, you have a revolution. You have something spark off, there's a big war, and you have all these people fighting for their rights. But that doesn't happen this time, does it? Verse 13 says, "The next day when Moses went out to visit his people again, he saw two Hebrew men fighting. He says, 'Why are you beating up your friend?' Moses said to the one who had started the fight. The man replied, 'Who appointed you to be our prince and judge? Are you going to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?' And then Moses was afraid, thinking, 'Everyone knows what I did.' And sure enough, Pharaoh heard what had happened, and he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in the land of Midian." See, Moses wants what's right, actually. He wants his people to be set free. Actually, he wants his people to live in harmony. He wants them to be unified in spirit, to say, like, this is who we are. We belong together. We are family. And yet he sees them fighting with each other. And when he sees them fighting with each other, that same sense of injustice wells up in his heart. And he's like, why are you guys fighting with each other? You guys shouldn't be fighting each other. You should be fighting this oppression. But the people just turn around. They look at him and say, are you going to kill us too? We saw what you did. Who do you think you are? Some sort of judge? Just because you're sort of this prince, you think you have power over us? It's funny because actually Moses wants these things which are good. Justice. Equality. And he wants to get it. He wants to make that change. And he's trying to do it by his own power. But it's all coming out pear-shaped. It's not working the way it should be. So he runs away. And he runs away to Midian in Exodus 2, picking up from verse 15, says, "When Moses arrived in Midian, he sat down beside a well. Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters who came as usual to draw water and fill the water troughs for their father's flocks. But some other shepherds came and chased them away. So Moses jumped up and rescued the girls from the shepherds, and then he drew water for their flocks." We see again, actually, Moses' character, right? He cannot stand it when he sees something wrong happening to someone else. He just can't. He's a man of action. And it just drives him crazy. So these shepherds come. It's none of his business. He's just been kicked out of Egypt. He's a foreigner now in a foreign land, as a foreign kid adopted in the family. And now he's here and he sees this. He's just like, whatever, none of my business. But he can't. He sees it, and he just has to do something. So he gets up, one guy, fights off all these shepherds who normally fight off bears and lions, by the way. And then maybe he is Superman. And then he gets all the water for the flocks for these women. And again, you see this thing where he has this heart, this passion, this desire for what's right. And not only that, he has a desire for action. But it seems like those things don't always turn out the way they should. So what happens is he ends up settling there. He works for this guy, and then he gets married. And then he's working for his father-in-law, Jethro. And in Exodus 3, there's this kind of life-changing moment. Sorry. Exodus 3, picking up from verse 1. Although it says 3 there, it just means chapter 3. "One day Moses was tending the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led the flock far into the wilderness and came to Sinai, the mountain of God. And there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the middle of a bush. Moses stared in amazement. Though the bush was engulfed in flames, it didn't burn up. 'This is amazing,' Moses said to himself. 'Why isn't that bush burning up? I must go and see it.'" Just an aside here, I think this is amazing because a burning bush that doesn't get consumed, that's essentially an eternal power supply.
And if one of us had that burning bush that never burnt up, we could power like homes and cities, somehow capturing that heat. Because it would never, right, you have an inconsumable fuel, right? But what's even cooler is when you realize, oh, that's God, inexhaustible, infinite, infinitely powerful. When you have this hope and this trust in God, there is this limitless amount of energy coming from him. Of course, Moses looks at this and thinks, ooh, a bush that never burns up. I can use this to create a car. And so he heads over to it and he has a look. And he goes, this is amazing. And when the Lord saw Moses coming to take a closer look, it's, I think that's such a funny line right there. Oh, Moses is coming. He wants to see what's going on here. God called to him from the middle of the bush saying, Moses, Moses. And Moses goes, here I am. Bush. I've seen your paintings. They're really good. Just kidding. For those of you who are up to date with the news, well done. I guess that's not really news. Moving along in verse 5, it says, do not come any closer, the Lord warned. Take off your sandals, for you are standing on holy ground. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And when Moses heard this, he covered his face because he was afraid to look at God. See, this is the first big point. This is actually the first time God introduces the idea of holiness. Up until this point, Abraham doesn't know what holiness is. He just knows that God is a God who makes promises and keeps them. But this is the first time holiness. And why is holiness coming up here? Because holiness and justice actually go together. Justice is things being done right, rightly, truthfully, honestly. What should be right is right. Holiness is what is right, being done right, and being right. And when Moses comes to this, you know, God's first words to him, apart from Moses, Moses, are, take off your shoes because this is holy ground. What God is saying is, look, I know your heart, I know what you desire, I know what you think is true, but you need to do this on my terms. In other words, you do things by God's terms, his standards, his way of life, not his own, not just by Moses' own power or his own passion. That's not going to be enough. He needs to do it God's way. And the powerful image is that Moses gets there and God calls out to him and he takes off his shoes and he kneels and he covers his face. He's like, whoa, okay, God, I will do it your way. Except he doesn't understand that that's what he's going to be asked to do. All he knows is that, whoa, something really amazing is happening here. God is amazing. It goes on in verse 7. It says, then the Lord told him, I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I have heard their cries of distress because of the harsh slave drivers. Yes, I am aware of their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and lead them out of Egypt into their own fertile and spacious land. It is land flowing with milk and honey, to the land where the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites now live. Look, the cry of the people of Israel has reached me, and I have seen how harshly the Egyptians abused them. Now go, for I am sending you to Pharaoh. You must lead my people Israel out of Egypt. What does God say to Moses? Essentially, he sings the song that Moses has on his heart, and he expresses it so clearly. Right? What does Moses want? He wants his people to have that freedom. He wants that place where they are in kind of this harmony, this right way of life, this right way of living. He wants them out of this oppression into the promised land. But he can't do it by his own strength. And God comes along and says, I've heard those cries. I know what's going on there. And I want to bring them out of that into a place where they are at peace, where things are right. And then he says to Moses, and I want you to lead them. Now you would think at this point Moses would be like, yes, now that's what I'm talking about. We have the same heart, you and I, God. I got you on this because I know that's exactly what I want. But Moses doesn't do that. Moses is like, oh, I don't know. Why does he do that? He does that because he tried last time and you failed miserably, and he doesn't think he can do it again. In fact, he doesn't necessarily trust God. He doesn't know whether God's going to be enough, whether this is going to work.
So he starts to make excuses, right? So first thing he says in verse 11, so Moses protested to God, who am I to appear before Pharaoh? Who am I to lead the people out of Israel? And God says, you know, I will be with you, and this is your sign that I am the one who sent you. When you have brought your people out of Egypt, you will worship God at this very mountain. So he says, look, I'm chosen you. I'm going to be there with you. I'm going to be your strength. And then Moses is still making excuses. Verse 13 says, Moses protested, if I go to the people of Israel and tell them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, they will ask me, what is his name? Then what should I tell them? All right, on one hand, these are valid questions. Like, if you're in a job interview and, you know, someone says, look, I want you to go ahead and do this, you'll be like, okay, well, if I just show up there, no one's going to respect me. I don't think Pharaoh's going to give me any authority. And then he says, well, how will the people aren't going to lead me, or aren't going to follow me just because of this? And God says, well, my name is I Am Who I Am. Say this to the people of Israel, I Am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my eternal name, my name to remember for all generations. What God is setting out here is that he's saying, he is, I am. I am above everything else in creation, in time. I am the one who has defined what is right, what is true. I am the one who understands true justice and true freedom. I am the one who gives hope and promise and fulfills those things. Moses, you have to trust me that I am. I am all that you will ever need. I am all that there ever was. I am the great I am. Well, then it goes on, right? Because actually Moses is still completely not convinced by this. Actually, it's pretty cool because after this part, God actually spells out his plan. Well, this is my plan. This is what's going to happen. You know, we're going to do this, and Pharaoh's going to reject it, but we're all going to get out of there. It's going to be awesome. And then Moses kind of protests again. We're in Exodus 4 now. He says, what if they won't believe me or listen to me? What if they say the Lord never appeared to you? Again, it's still the same question. Like, I don't know. I don't think, I don't have the confidence. I don't think they're going to believe me. This is kind of crazy. All right, let's stop for a second. Isn't this your spiritual life when you talk to people about God? Aren't these exactly the same questions you have when you're like, oh, I want to talk to my friend about God? And then it's like, oh, but what if they don't believe me? What if they think I'm crazy? How will I prove to them that you really exist, God? What if they ask your name? What if they ask me these questions that I don't have any answer for? And you'll be like, yeah, what if I say, God is I am who I am? I don't think that's going to work, God. And it's exactly, we're just like Moses coming up with excuse after excuse. But I know what you guys are thinking. No, Bert, these are not excuses. These are valid points. Because have you seen people today? They're not going to believe anything I have. What God is still trying to say is, look, we do things on God's terms. We do things by God's way, not our own way. That's what it means to trust him, by saying, actually, God, you know what? You are right, and I'm going to do it your way, and I'm going to try it your way, and if I look like a fool and it fails, so be it, but I'm going to do it your way, not my way. So, what happens, right? And then God says, look, I'll give you some signs. Take your staff, throw on the staff, and it becomes a snake. Pick up the snake, becomes a staff. Put your hand in your thing. Oh, take it out. You got disease. Put it back away. Oh, the disease is gone. You're healed. So it's like and then if that doesn't work, pour some of this into the water, and the whole Nile turns to blood. That's a pretty good sign. And Moses is like, oh, fine. Okay. Then it goes on. Then Moses pleads with the Lord. Oh, Lord, I'm not very good with words. I never have been, and I'm not now. Even though you have spoken to me, I get tongue-tied, and my words get tangled. God, he's like, surprised he ever got married. Then the Lord asked Moses, who makes a person's mouth? Who decides whether people speak or do not speak, hear or do not hear, see or do not see? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go.
I will be with you as you speak, and I will instruct you in what to say. That's what God's saying, right? Look, my terms, my life, I'm showing you what it is. If Christ has called you to follow him, then you should have faith that he is going to see you forward to accomplish the things that God desires for you. You don't have to be afraid. You can be afraid, but you still walk and trust in him. You don't let that fear become doubt that prevents you from moving forward. It's still saying, God, look, I trust you. Following God means doing things on his terms. His way is the way. It's not about doing it just by ourselves. It's actually seeking and trusting God. Say, God, actually, you show me. I trust you. Even with the smallest bit of trust I have, the knowledge that I'm probably going to fail, it means I still want to pursue what's right. There's three things that kind of happen here. It's one is recognizing his holiness. That's the first thing that happens with Moses. He recognizes that God is holy. He's pure. That his way of life is the right way. The second thing he realizes is God's wisdom. God's the one who has the plan. God's the one who has the authority to do this thing. He's the one who has the power, recognizing God's power. And then the third is recognizing his calling. You know, God is telling Moses, go. Now, isn't that the same thing that Jesus tells us? Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And before this, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. And at the end of that, he says, and I will be with you always, even till the end of the age. That's very, very similar to what God says to Moses, isn't it? I am with you. Go. I will be with you. But it's not just enough to recognize these things. You actually have to trust it. Trusting his holiness, trusting his power, and trusting his calling. The difference between recognizing and trusting is recognizing is saying, yes, I can see that you can do these things. Trusting him says, God, I believe that you can do those things in my life. That you can use my life for these things. I trust you in that. But finally, the last one is that you have to submit to his holiness, submit to his power, and submit to his calling. And this is the hardest part, actually. All of those things take effort on ours, but the last part, submitting. Do you know how hard it is in this modern day and age to stand up for what God stands up for? To be an advocate for justice? To be an advocate for orphans and widows? To be generous with our time and our money? To be eager to help the poor? You know, in our society, we are always fighting against materialism, the desire that we have for more for ourselves. We're fighting against actually technology, which demands our time but takes us away from people. Even the more we wrestle even against racial conflict, because it's easy nowadays for us to deny the rest of the world. I'm not just talking about racism in this country, but what happens in other parts of the world and writing it off as just, it's just what happens in those poor countries. God is calling us and challenging us to be his people, his force for good, his advocates for those who are in need. You know, he didn't make the church just so we can sit in here and sing songs, did he? He called us to be a people to go, to tell them, to say, you know what? God desires to set you free, to come out of the slavery and your addictions and your sin and your pain and your hurt, to know the freedom of what it's like to be with God. It's that calling to say, come and be part of the promised land with him. And that means making hard choices sometimes, like saying, okay, well, I'm not going to sleep with my boyfriend or girlfriend. Or it means I'm not going to just chase money for my job. Or it's maybe having lots of money from your job and saying, I'm not just going to spend it all for myself. I want to use this to bless people. It's difficult, but it's not at the same time. Because when you begin to live the right way, when you begin to trust God and you submit to Him and you say, you know what, actually, God, it's your way, not my way, suddenly that becomes a joy. You're not fighting with Him. You're like, yes, actually, God, you seem to know what's right. Actually, God, you don't just seem to, you do know what's right. And living your way, it seems to be the best way. In fact, it is the best way. And Moses understood this because at the beginning, he wanted these good things, justice, freedom, but he wanted to do it his way, and that didn't work. And so we learn to do it God's way. As we come to a time of worship, I want you to start to pray and to use this time to say, actually, God, set this fire in my heart. God, I want that burning bush in my heart speaking to me, telling me that actually I am holy ground. I am called by you, and I will go and move and walk with you. I will trust you. Even if I'm unemployed or looking for a job, even if I don't know if I'm going to finish this career, even if I struggle with sins which seem impossible to overcome, even if my marriage is falling apart or I feel alone, I will trust you because your way is the way. Should we come and worship? Let's pray. Father, we can trust in no one else, can we? And Lord, as we come to worship you, we want to stop and we want to recognize that you are the Holy One. You're the one of truth and of love and of hope and of peace and of promise. And there is no one like you. Lord, we want to recognize your power, that actually you are the one who makes mouths speak, that has people hear. So let's trust in that, Father God, that you can do amazing things like heal, restore, redeem. And so we trust in your calling then, that you call us to be your people. Set a fire in our heart, Lord, that we might burn for you. In your name we pray. Amen.